Malloy here. Time for another story and another trip through the Wind Door. Listeners, and welcome to another episode of Through the Wind Door. Folks, this is a big one. The penultimate episode on Secret Rooms, where we discuss the final chapters 21 through 24. Kinda hard to believe we've come as far as we have. We first started recording 9 months ago, first started publishing 7 months ago. In that time, we have covered 2 whole books in the New Century cycle. We recorded our intro, 15 full episodes, 5 interviews, 1 future speculation, and a partridge in a pear tree. Toby and I have hit our stride and has only emboldened us to dream bigger, as if tackling the upcoming Tiger's Eye isn't going to be enough of a challenge. But before we look too far ahead, let's finish what we started. We just had the major plot twist, which we covered in brief during the previous episode, where all of a sudden Krieger and Greta reveal themselves to be more than they are and just fucking nope out of the House of Verstekt, leaving James and Abigail to pick up the pieces. Bye! Have fun not storming the castle! Have fun
it's the
having
inverse.
The castle being stormed, yeah! When I started doing the notes for this episode, I'm in the habit of trying to do them in chronological order, even if I came up with ideas, when I write them down and be like, okay, so this happens, then this happens, and bang, on top of the list here, the thing that came to mind as I was listening to the audio drama and then like have the text of the novel in front of me as well, suddenly realizing that the swearing is different. In the book, it's just flat out Jesus Christ. In the audio drama, it's a far more colorful and exciting holy mother of fuck. And just personal enjoyment aside of hearing Sharon voice these kinds of intense colloquialisms, the thing that immediately came to mind is something I learned way back when watching the HBO drama Deadwood. And I happen to know that Alex is a huge fan of Deadwood. It's going to impact much later stories.
No spoilers.
But the thing that I learned is that Deadwood, first of all, has a reputation for having a lot of swearing. Just fucks and shits and even more imaginative things coming out of specific main characters' mouths, but over the course of the show, just everybody's mouth. And an interesting note to all of that is that what people thought was profanity back during the time of the Wild West, which is essentially still this time, is very different. Back then, the things that they were far more concerned with were more in the camp of blasphemy, like taking God's name in vain. So uttering something like Jesus Christ actually makes more sense, but in a modern context, it doesn't have the same kind of impact. So there was some creative changes made to Deadwood, and it feels like Alex may have invoked that law here as well. It's possible that a more colorful oath just flowed better when the audio drama was being recorded, or it has more dramatic effect. But seeing the two disparate instances, it's just very notable. And it isn't just that one moment, even in that chapter itself, something that is in the text as darn tootin' makes a transition in the audio drama to Damn Right. And there isn't necessarily a huge difference between the two, but on the other hand, Darn Tootin' would tend to be the kind of oath that someone would have in order to avoid saying something more profane or blasphemous or anything like that. So it's the changes.
Which Abigail clearly doesn't have an issue with in this particular moment. So, well, I don't know about you. My household never would have allowed me to say Darn Tootin'.
Well, so one of the interesting things that you point out, I'm going to re-say that. One of the things that you noted in response to my initial plot point there is that Abigail is capable at this point of controlling her feelings and her responses enough to be appropriate in response to different scenarios. And you use the example of the confrontation with Mayor Buck way back.
Why do we keep bringing him up?
You know, he's the gift that keeps on giving.
And not the word I'd use for it. He's the dog shit that sticks to your shoe.
He's the dog shit that sticks to your shoe. Okay, that's a metaphor that I can get behind. Absolutely. The thing that occurs to me when you were talking about that she has some level of self-control over herself, some level of appropriateness, some level of reading the room or using whatever words she feels are going to be best for the situation. The thing that I wonder now is if this is the one of the things that either she felt she had to learn or that Catherine sort of helped her out with in the aftermath of everything that happened prior to Lucy's death at Weirwood. Because I have to imagine what we experience seeing that section of their life is what happens if Abigail just gives all of her impulses free rein. It happens when she punches the boy back in Clearwater and during her first introduction to her, and she is more than happy to just go off on a tear, chasing down Doris and acting on her first impulse in almost every situation. When she comes back and she sees James and Lucy kissing, she acts immediately without thought and just completely emotionally. Re-listening to this point now, it seems a little unfair to blame her for constantly going off half-cocked, considering she was a teenager. While the thing about helping Lucy leave, there was perhaps more consideration behind it, it still doesn't change the fact that after seeing one of the people that matters most to her die as a result of her actions, that learning a different way of being, something that nobody else really tried to instill in her prior to this, would have been particularly important to her. You know, it's not like the diplomacy that she shows when approaching Samson to begin with comes out of nowhere. She actually does very well for what should be on some level her first outing into that kind of diplomacy. When we hear about the story that happened defending Weirwood, that is really her playing a role as being more like a leader and a field marshal, but also a warrior, rather than being a diplomat for the first time. So,
and it's a comfortable amount of responsibility for her to handle. Catherine is still the overseer of all these different groups of Weirwood as they defend it. And I shan't go into too much specifics because our listeners who have followed our recommended reading list haven't actually read the specifics of that. But suffice it to say, Abigail is like a captain or of a squad, or she has enough responsibility that she's an officer in that particular encounter, but she isn't the person upon whom all responsibility lies. That is still Catherine. But with Samson, as you say, that's basically her first experience of, right, this is a situation where whatever we say, whatever we do, will have significant repercussions. And now I'm giving all of that to Abigail, and she can't defer to anyone else. She has more responsibility than she's ever had, and that's why she wants to have enough responsibility that she can make a difference. But if all the difference comes down to her, that's when she starts to actually feel a bit more uncomfortable.
I mean, that's possible. I feel like some of the uncomfortability may have been more due to the fact that she wasn't succeeding, and of course halfway through when she realized that maybe the tack that she was taking was actually potentially leading her more into hot water than it was into something that was going to lead to success. This was a situation she couldn't shoot or punch her way out of, unlike how it felt with Elkview Road or really any previous circumstance. She's always been a knuckle duster. For the first time, she's exercising some of the things that she learned from watching Catherine in an environment where people don't necessarily have the same natural respect for her, or at the very least, respect for the fact that they all have to work together or they're going to fall. Mary has no reason to pay attention to anything that Abigail says and is going to do what she feels is best for her people, just like Abigail is trying to do what she has been asked to do by the RSA and by Annie. We're sliding backwards a little bit into stuff that we've already talked about, but she clearly sees that there is time for restraint, and when she is, I don't know if necessary, you use the term safe at a certain point.
It's almost like she knows that she has the elbow room to just be herself, and there are zero repercussions to her saying, holy fucking shit, what the hell was this? And to show enough of her unrestrained self, whereas in situations where it actually comes down to diplomacy, like with Mayor Buck, she has the capacity to hold that back. But I think in this moment, I appreciate that the level of her expletives are indicative of her feeling like she is somewhere that she can process this in exactly the way that she wants to, which is to say, what the fuck was this?
I mean, to be perfectly honest, considering the stress of the situation and the incredulity of what they experienced, it could just be that she let down any inhibitions and just reverted to type a little bit. By the same token, one of the things that I've heard, particularly in terms of being a soldier or something similar but not quite, like being a first responder, fireman, an EMT, something else like that, we all naturally have a fight or flight reaction that you have to be able to train yourself out of to a certain extent, because when we go into that mode, it interferes with our ability to make rational decisions, because it's all about protecting the self. So being able to keep your head, as the saying goes, when everybody else is losing theirs, that feels like something that she probably felt that she would have had to learn as part of being a leader. So she may be in complete control this whole time, even if it feels like she isn't. It's a weird combination of six of one, half a dozen of the other, because another thing that we're going to get into during the discussion of these chapters is how even after we've had a whole book and seen their past and walking into the future of the rest of the new century, this is very much the beginning of their arc and not necessarily the completion of an arc in and of itself.
Yeah, we've got a lot of one-eyed adventures ahead of us.
Oh, God damn it. Well, no, okay. That's not a spoiler at this point. You listeners, you should have read to the stories. You should realize that...
Look, you shouldn't be... You shouldn't be playing this over you reading this. We're not the commentary track.
We're not riff tracks. No, nothing like that. Moving swiftly along, one of the things we got into last episode, where we're comparing Let Them Go and Secret Rooms to Alien and Aliens. This is one of the moments that resonated very much, showing why I felt that Secret Rooms was more like the sequel, because they start counting supplies, their candles, and then their ammunition and their food, and it has a strong resonance with a similar moment of taking stock and finding that stock diminished after the dropship crashes during the midpoint of Aliens. And you also brought up that we already know that Resident Evil was one of the major influences on both of these stories, and one of the distinct concerns of those games is all about managing your inventory when you have limited supplies.
I think that definitely comes into play here. But of course, both of these examples, while I wouldn't be surprised if this is meant to be alluding to that, it is, of course, a common thing in fiction to ratchet up tension and establish the stakes, that it's not just about fulfilling the mission's objective, whether it's getting through the mansion alive, surviving the night, or escaping, or what have you. It's achieving the objective while you're poorly equipped and you manifestly don't have a second shot at it. One of the examples that came to mind while we were thinking about this was in the specifically Return of the King in the Lord of the Rings films, when emphasize the bread that Frodo and Sam are trying to allocate, and Sam is saying, oh, well, we should have enough for the journey home. And then when it actually is gone, even though it doesn't come up as a significant issue in the sequence of events that we see in the rest of the film, the scenes do treat it as a significant point that we've run out, this is a big problem. And it's just a way to emphasize that these characters want to make sure that they are well equipped and well prepared, because they don't have a second shot at it. They can't just reload a save and have another go. They have to make sure that they do this right. And so taking a moment to reflect and see, okay, what's our status right now? And seeing it's not great is always an effective way to say we're on the back foot right now.
Well, tropes are the way they are for a reason. Bad writing can always lean too heavily on things that are elements of other pieces of media. Tropes specifically generally come up with film, but if you actually look at something like TVtropes.com, which mentions TV right there in the title, it's all some form of writing, and anybody that is writing any kind of story, whether it's for the small screen, for the big screen, for a book, for a comic, for a video game, whatever, there's always going to be narrative shorthand that comes into play that is meant to invoke something that someone may have experienced elsewhere. Sometimes the better thing to do to make your narrative more exciting to the reader is to point out the trope, put a little flag on it, and then say, right, we're going to throw that away and do something completely different, subverting the narrative or flipping the narrative on its head, whatever it is. But it doesn't necessarily mean that using these things aren't bad in and of themselves, particularly when you're setting up a particular moment that is meant to be narratively compelling. Then the experience of relating it back to the feelings that you had during a different piece of media that might have had particular resonance with you, that's never necessarily a bad thing.
It's just acknowledging a pattern in the fiction that we enjoy. And once you recognize that pattern, you can see what the differences are and what the context surrounding them are, which makes each case of it unique. And I think in this example, it's not just a case of, oh, Abigail said that line from that movie. That means that this story is just that movie. And I'm thinking, there's quite a few differences.
Because we're talking about patterns and how they either played straight or subverted, that actually leads us right into the next consideration that comes into the story, where as they're doing the taking of stock and James is noticing the fruit, all of a sudden his brain goes into overdrive and attempts to convince Abigail and us that perhaps everything that they'd experienced just now didn't in fact actually happen. This is where one of those patterns actually comes into play. One of the stories that I brought up, it feels like a long time ago now, in regards to influences for James's creation, were the depiction of Sherlock Holmes as portrayed by Robert Downey Jr. for the big screen. It's here that I need to put in that we are spoiling the Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes movie in order to talk about secret rooms so that I can show how expectations are defied. The plot twist isn't necessarily a new one, since the Sherlock mythos is built around explaining the seemingly impossible, and goodness knows there's hundreds of other later works that use the concept of a clever detective or scientist or some other similar protagonist to do this exact thing. One of the significant elements of that particular movie is that their understanding of things would seem to imply that even in a world of science and logic, these magical occurrences keep happening that Sherlock doesn't seem to be able to rebut a lot of the time. But then in the final culmination of the story, he actually goes through each of these supposedly supernatural phenomenon and debunks every single one by pointing out all of the details that he'd been keeping back, but that he'd found evidence for each of them in every single circumstance. So when James is going through that pattern here, it's hard not to get caught up in that. He's pretty convincing, and Alex is very convincing in the way that he voice acts that entire experience, but it leads to this fascinating cognitive dissonance where we already know that magic has to be an element of things that are going on, at the very least, if only because of the paratext of we've seen things that modern science can't necessarily explain. I mean, for fuck's sake, the name of this podcast is Through the Wind Door, so that's kind of giving away the game a little bit right there.
Yeah, we're not naming ourselves after a red herring here.
Yeah, but it still means that this conflict and this interaction between James and Abigail is still manages to be very compelling, if only because it's understandable to see how James could come to these conclusions. And as I recall, they don't ever necessarily find out the truth about that fruit. One should even point out that they fell asleep while Krieger was having his private conversation in German with Greta. So there's nothing saying that the fruit doesn't necessarily have some potential soporific effects. It may very well be that either Krieger intended that so that they could plan whatever they were going to do next with the insurance that no one was going to interrupt them or potentially figure out, hey, there might be something that's going on. Or alternately, it might not even be a property of the dried fruit itself. Krieger, as later referenced, has a stock room full of supplies. He could very easily have added something to the fruit in order to ensure that effect.
It's the sort of thing which feels like it is framed as if we are uncovering a dramatic revelation, which gives it that weight. And James, before the fruit comes into play, does actually take on board the possibility that, yeah, we did just see a portal. He is not looking straight away for evidence to disprove the fact that they just saw a portal to another world. In his narration, he is writing or recording this in a way which reflects the fact that at the time, he really did think that there was too many factors. they experience too many of the same things. This must have happened. And so it's not like his role in this scene is to be the skeptic who is so staunchly set in his ways that he is looking for any scrap of information that supports his preconceived ideas. This is a moment of him seeing something which changes the game, which kind of adds that weight to the evidence, because it's something that is significant enough that it does change his mind. There's these moments in a lot of Sherlock Holmes-like stories where, oh, this mystery of this great big hound of the Baskervilles on the foggy moors. There's these urban legends and the heroes wonder if it might just be true. And then by the end, everything's revealed. And one of my favorite examples is in the Professor Layton series of games, where each one has this almost supernatural or science fiction mystery of, wait, is there really something at play here? And I shan't get into specifics, but what I adore about the solutions to those is that more often than not, they'll say, no, it wasn't this unreasonable and unbelievable thing. It was actually this far more unreasonable thing, which we are framing as if it is the logical solution. And you think, frankly, I think it's more likely that there was a ghost haunting us.
Yeah, sometimes Occam's razor actually points towards the supernatural rather than away from it. Just because James appears to be the smartest person in the room, it doesn't necessarily mean that everything he ever says should be taken as gospel. And even he realizes that. As Abigail is playing the skeptic to his logic, he's like, okay, I'm willing to entertain the possibility that I'm wrong. Let me see where your thread takes you. And he gives her the opportunity to give an alternate explanation. And so the following sequence of events of chapter 21 and 22 incorporates a lot of James using the skills that he has at his disposal and Abigail using her own gut instinct or even supernatural insight that she didn't necessarily know that she had right up until the point that ghosts actually started appearing to her. And those two things work really well in concert to uncover the important discovery of the story.
It's the sort of mystery that could have taken a lot longer if, depending on how a different writer would have structured this, slash a different pair of people, if they were in these circumstances, they may not have found the mystery of Charlotte and the Starlit Orb. The fact that everything from them discovering the wind door and the pair finding and making contact with the orb and obtaining the Starlit Eyes all happens within one chapter is testament to how their two different skill sets are kind of propelling each other forward along this path. James develops a theory, Abigail questions it, and through that questioning of each other and each one using enough of their own, not just skill set, but their own impulse to take this action or not take this action, they build off each other, and that leads them to making that discovery really rather quickly when you consider everything that's been going on and the amount of revelations. They do get to the hidden secrets at the heart of this house. I don't know how long Krieger was anticipating that people would have to work this out.
Here I'm going to expound a little in regards to the problem of what Krieger may or may not have intended. There's a lot I can't say yet because it involves recent revelations from Uncivil Outlaw. Based only on the information given in Secret Rooms, it seems very likely that Krieger wanted both the information and the power to go into the hands of the cartographers. Maybe not James and Abigail specifically, but it's easy to believe him when he said that he wanted to help the cartographers, as he set up the key to be found that would give a hunting party a chance to find the Starlit Orb. The problem here is unintended consequences. It's very likely the original plan was to leave after the cartographers left, and allow everyone to find the journals and the orb, perhaps to correct the mistakes made by the trio. But everything changed when the Wendigos attacked. The smell of the horses likely drew them in, and once that happened, how much time everyone had was thrown out of whack. Because based on what we do know, Krieger and Greta were more than happy to give assistance, as long as they could do it consequence-free. They did not want to stick around and provide direct explanations, either for fear of being used, being held to account for the Wendigo in the first place, or both. And that desire to preserve their own agency can draw a through line to things going as badly as they did. We can't know for certain how things would have turned out had Krieger and Greta made a different choice. They could have stayed to help the pair survive. They could have taken James and Abigail with them. But given the way things played out, saying that any of this was actually part of some kind of plan is disingenuous at best. As the saying goes, no plan survives first contact with the enemy. But let's move off that subject for a bit to talk about the other instance of the supernatural present in these last few chapters. Ghosts. I ended up cutting a lot of the original conversation we had because once more I was using Crimson Peak as an example of how ghosts are used in narrative, and as before, I don't want to spoil it. But something we eventually came around to is questioning whether Charlotte is an actual ghost or something else. In the last book, we talked a lot about the ghosts in the penultimate chapter, and the fact that we couldn't say for certain whether they were real or creations of the mind. In this case, the available evidence cleaves far closer to something existing in our world. For one thing, although it's Abigail that experiences the ghost itself, there is evidence that James did experience something tangible related to Charlotte's presence. For another, Charlotte gives them information that they wouldn't otherwise have had. And even if one could argue that their unconscious minds could have pieced things together, particularly if they were under some narcotic effect in addition to the wind door being real, the Vox tube was picking up sounds that it is very likely the ghost herself made. In regards to why it is that Abigail can see the ghost while James cannot, we'll share our thoughts on why that is a little bit later. In the meantime, one of the things that Toby pointed out is that unlike some stories where ghosts are very elemental creatures that are unable to communicate well, this shade of Charlotte seems very articulate and responsive, even if she can't always communicate in words. She's even subject to seeming cause and effect, because when James and Abigail take possession of the orb, the shade's eyes become more human instead of unworldly like Greta's were.
I find myself wondering just how much we're actually going to learn along the way of how certain supernatural elements of New Century work. It's not an uncommon thing that, and particularly from many things that I've heard Alex say, that there are some things that work better when they are unexplained, and that explaining them kind of ruins the overall experience. On the other hand, these things can also be contained to individual narratives, such as the way that we talk about how very little is explained in Let Them Go in order to keep that aura of mystery and dread alive for that particular story, and now already into Secret Rooms, some of the things that we didn't understand the origin of or the boundaries of have been gone on to be explained in this story. I figure it's possible that, based on some of the things that Alex has said, that he actually has a Bible that has explanations to everything that has happened, but it doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to take us through it step by step over the course of three phases and is going to reveal everything.
Put it this way, if he ever chose to show this metaphorical Bible to us or share excerpts from it, if he handed it to us, he would definitely rip a good portion of the pages out.
No. Have it be like Memento and just like redact this, redact that, redact this entire page.
And meanwhile, we just glance down at our own notes and if one of them just says, don't trust his lies.
All right. So, yes, we were discussing supernatural, how it manifests. We don't necessarily know how that is going to play out for the entire rest of it, or even the potential significance of the earlier pet name that Krieger had for Greta about her being non-human, you know, what is the extent of that particular commentary? To be perfectly honest, we don't even necessarily know that Greta and Charlotte aren't sisters. That was a potential lie in order to explain the fact that he was living with the two of them or whatever it was before he realized that the three of them were in some form of a throuple. There is still a lot that we don't know. Like, we're completely up to date at this point. There are two books in the middle of being written, and we, of course, have done a show on all of the titles of the books that Alex plans to write over the course of Phase 2, but we don't yet know how much of their story we are going to get, and their story is very much not done. Just because they have noped out of this particular story and left a mystery for other people to uncover, they are, as Alex would say and does say about many of his recurring characters and protagonists, they will return.
Mm-hmm.
So, talking some more about the supernatural. Based on the text, we must naturally ask ourselves, what is it about the ghost or the people involved that Abigail can see Charlotte so clearly and James cannot? Is there a supernatural reason? A thematic reason? The difference in kind between them? Or some combination of factors? The one thing that I was able to grab onto, and again, I don't have enough experience with other Gothic narratives, and specifically other stories where there is a female protagonist and they are able to connect with the spirit world where other people are incapable of doing that. But as a part of the definitive edition, it has now been established that Abigail really likes stories. They were a huge part of her childhood at Weirwood. An open mind with a strong imagination is potentially more capable of believing things outside the natural experience than a particularly rigid mind that has been taken to a very specific extreme in the case of James.
Narratively, it just makes sense to the reader that James and Abigail are being positioned as a pair. They have been positioned as a pair before this, and that's another reason why the added chapters help prime you for this finale, because they give you context of the history that these two have had working in a partnership as a team and making decisions together. And it makes a sense to you that if we're seeing how one balances with the other, that if James is particularly scientific and his mind leans towards that, that the other half of this duo would have the ability to maybe make sense or be recipient of this supernatural phenomena.
We have talked about the duality and discussed about how, while on some levels they may be bad for each other, on other levels they are a natural fit to each other. The things that make them work well together and the things that piss them off might very well be part of the same parcel. Like, it's not unusual for narrative couples, either in just partnerships or even with unresolved sexual tension, shall we say, for them to have conflict. It's a truism that sometimes the things that frustrate us the most are also something that we find ourselves attracted to. If you see in someone else something that you yourself lacks. So, you know, it all makes a great deal of sense, not just in terms of narrative cohesion, but just in terms of the experience of being in the world with other people.
There is a truism of human nature that we're seeing with these two.
Exactly, yeah. So far, we're doing really well, because one conversation about one thing on my list leads right on to the next conversation, because James becomes so goddamn irritated with Abigail the second she decides, you know what, you're right, fine, we'll find another way in. Oh, oops, I've bull-rushed the door. God hammer damn that... it, Abigail!
Hammer that renegade button!
Renegade interrupt for the win. Bam.
And James is just there at the D&D table and is like, God damn it, are you aiming for a total party wipe?
Fortunately, no one else has actually died yet. That Annie went off to gain help and everything. I just find it tickles me pink that one of the things that you cleaved very well to during the previous episode, when I brought up the nature of her trying to figure out if she's going to climb the fence, and James commenting aesthetically on like, oh, well, we better be prepared to lose some limbs here if you decide to do that. This is the natural progression where James has completely lost his cool because Abigail is Abigailing all over the place.
Don't you, Abigail? I'm an Abigail.
Don't do the thing. I'ma do the thing.
Oh, you did the thing. How could you have done the thing?
This is a relief. Yeah, we have fun. I'm saying this is a relief because, you know, we always manage to have these moments during our conversations, but, you know, in particular, with the everything that's going on and with the seriousness of some of the things that we have yet to cover as this gothic narrative comes to an end, it's a release to be able to have just moments where we're just giggling with glee at our favorite parts of the story. So, you know, Abigail did the thing. James yelled at her for it, made all the more intense by once more the severity of the situation. And again, this is part of the reason why the choice to have these events play out in real time rather than referring back to them in a journal, that was a good decision to have that moment available to us in both the written version and the audio drama version, because otherwise it feels there isn't the same tenseness and emotional impact behind it. Because whenever you're doing anything, whenever you're referring back to something, the weight of the emotions aren't going to hit you as hard. And on top of that, if you very, very often, even though the instructions that would have been given by the RSA to its cartographers would be to be as honest as possible in your journal transcript about what happened, because it doesn't help if you're dishonest about it. We need all of the facts, no matter how embarrassing, in order to plot the best plans and have the best understanding of whatever it is that's going on. Also,
and then I fought off like 24 Wendigos.
Yeah, exactly. That sounds really good. But it may mean that, like, okay, then we're going to send you solo on a mission because clearly you can handle 24 Wendigos by yourself. that's the darker side of the reward for work well done is more work.
Oh, I'm writing that down.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm sorry. I can't take credit for that one. As I recall, I think that's actually a quote from one of Tolkien's books. I don't know if it was The Hobbit or if it was Lord of the Rings, but that was definitely something that Gandalf said.
It would be.
Yeah, exactly. So what was the point that I was trying to make there? There was perhaps a natural tendency when writing down anything in a journal to potentially downplay certain aspects of it, or to have the rational mind come up with explanations that wouldn't have necessarily have been as true in the heat of the moment. And it's definitely evident when Annie is listening back to the Vox tubes play out themselves, and Abigail in particular is very uncomfortable with her hearing all of the conclusions that she came to, the dark places her mind went to, the willingness that she had to sacrifice herself, even though it speaks well for her as a person, as a leader, to want to protect others. It's still a very emotional moment as it plays out. And Abigail hasn't gotten to the place with Annie yet where she feels completely at ease with her. you know, to a certain extent, it's, I'm not sure that they ever necessarily get to that place ever. They get closer, but not to the same level of the trust that Abigail and James place in each other, at least. Mm-hmm. So
there is a feeling with any case where you are narrating or recalling memories that the moment you narrate something, you are shaping it with a bias. You are reshaping events as they are happening by describing them in your own words, even if you're aiming to be as true to the events as they were happening as possible. There is going to be an unavoidable reshaping of things in order to make it fit a narration. So by having these recordings that place you in the moment, as you say, I think it helps remove some of the distance between Annie and Abigail, where Annie is able to see Abigail with no extra narration. It's just all honest in the moment stuff. And not only that, but she gets to see Abigail when she's not around. She gets to see what Abigail did with zero supervision. Mm-hmm. And there's also, I think, whenever you're narrating or writing something down, there is an unavoidable distance between the moment you are recalling it and the events that you are recalling. It's unavoidable. So in order for the reader to put themselves into that headspace, you remove the distance. You just see how events are playing out. And that's important for the purposes of tension building in chapter 22, when there is a lot of very real physical threats and dangers, some of which are just the characters themselves in terms of either they contemplate very dark places of not going on any further, or they say, leave me behind, you need to get out of it. They both do that, and so they have to overcome that. So there is a lot of visceral tension at work. But in chapter 21, when there's not really as much of a threat other than the fact that, okay, there's something spooky going on, this could go south, it's more of a, we're trying to work out a puzzle. Mm-hmm. And by putting you in the room with them and putting you in the room at the same time, it creates this atmosphere where you're not removed from it. You are seeing why they make each decision that they do. And because this is as significant a moment as it is, where they both acquire the power of the orb, the starlit eyes, it's kind of really important that you see it for exactly how it happened, and not them going, okay, this is going to sound weird, but we followed a ghost. It makes it more satisfying to see it with none of the like colouring in that narration provides, even if it's unintentional.
I do want to talk some more about the construction of the story and the audio drama as relates to sounds, because that's the next thing on our list. But one thought that I had while listening to you talking about the journals and Annie listening to them, it feels on some level that Secret Rooms is almost bookended a little bit by someone narrating a story and Annie listening to it, because we have the story that Catherine related to her that set them off on this journey to begin with, and how Catherine being completely emotionally available to Annie brought the two of them closer together and helped them make the decisions that would be best for each of them along the way, but also brought them much closer together as two individuals. That is also now present between Annie and Abigail, and even to some extent James, even though he has far less to say about his experiences, being still the very taciturn type that has not quite gotten to a place where he can let anybody in, even Abigail only in a limited sense, or at the very least during times of emotional stress. So I like the juxtaposition there. I don't necessarily know that it was intended, but as we like to say, if it seems like there's a pattern there, that could have been constructed in that manner, it's very likely that that is what Alex did, because he puts way too much consideration into everything he does.
It's certainly a piece of structuring that would have been more apparent in the original audio drama, where the point at which Annie hears Catherine's story was how Secret Rooms originally started. And also the fact that Catherine was originally voiced by Sharon as well. So it would have been Annie sitting down and listening to stories from two characters that were voiced by Sharon and then getting to know them more. So I think that those connections are still apparent even in the definitive edition, but I think that that adds weight to your interpretation that when you consider how the story was originally structured.
We'll get into a lot more next time about what differences are in there and how things were added but also taken out to allow for the definitive edition to flow more smoothly, but also to work more in tandem with the cartographer's handbook so that the two of them are even more companion pieces now than they were when they were initially published. And that's where we will leave it for this week. Next week is obviously part two, followed by our final episode where we bring the wide-angle lens on the story as a whole. I haven't yet decided where I'm going to put Matt Wardle's interview into the mix. I know that some folks have been chomping at the bit to hear us talk about Tiger's Eye, and believe me, we are excited too. I'll have to see how things play out over the next couple of months. For now, let me leave you with one of my favorite musical pieces. With a song talking about collected regrets, being ready to hope, and things always being darkest before the dawn, this music could perhaps refer to multiple places in New Century. But when I started to plan ahead for what music would work with what episode, I happened to pencil in this piece. As I was reflecting on how the lyrics worked for Secret Rooms, I just ended up pushing the button. From the powerful pipes of Florence and the Machine, here is Shake It Out.
Regrets collect like old friends, here to relive your darkest moments. I can see no way, I can see no way, and all of the ghouls come out to play. That every demon wants his pound of flesh, but I like to keep some things to myself. I like to keep my issues strong. It's always done.